And now, live from New York City via Los Angeles, California, it's time for The View from Over Here with the man who has a view for all seasons, your host, Stan Weisleder.
Hi there, Stan Weisleder here in the studio with Malcolm Berman, our producer. We are on CRN Digital Talk. That goes out over the entire world, our planet. And for those who are a little bit more esoteric, we are on crntalk.com, which is the internet, and that goes out not only all over the planet, but into the far reaches of the galaxy and beyond.
How's that, Malcolm?
All right. Hey, we got some very interesting news items today. Have you heard the latest, and I mean really the latest, from La Habra, California? That's a wealthy community of about 5,300 people on the Los Angeles and Orange County border. Well, that's exactly what it is, Malcolm. It's poop. Llama poop, to be exact. Or, if you prefer, llama shit. Some people thought that they could whip up a batch of an eco-friendly fertilizer that they referred to as llama brew, but they somehow forgot to factor in the intolerable smell from the open drums of animal waste that was stored in their backyard, and that the local natives, their neighbors, would be getting more than just restless. After all, you know, everyone calmed down and took a deep breath. A Los Angeles Superior Court judge ruled that the production of llama brew has to stop. Now they can all breathe easy.
Well, what's the difference between llama brew and other excrements from horses that they use as fertilizers?
No difference as far as I'm concerned, but maybe they just had a few llamas, you know, lollying about in their backyard, and they wanted to make use of their excrement.
Did you think it's possible that it's a part of that immigration problem? Because llamas are from where are llamas from? Are they from Chile?
They're from Llama Land.
They're from Llama Land, and I don't know whether they're legal llamas or undocumented llamas.
Illegal llamas. These llamas didn't have green cards. Anyway, let's get on with the news. Chefs now have to wear rubber gloves or use instruments during the preparation of food so as to reduce the amount of transmitted diseases, particularly those diseases or ailments that make you go to the restroom on and on and on. Like they say, look, Ma, no hands. But more important than wearing rubber gloves or using instruments, I think that the chefs and cooks who prepare the food that we eat should be required to wash their hands every time they go to the restroom.
They are required to wash their hands.
And then maybe we wouldn't have to go to the restroom as much. They may be required to do it, but do they do it?
Well, there is a very funny episode on Seinfeld. And basically they go to this restaurant, George and Jerry and Elaine. And Jerry's in the bathroom, and the chef or the owner of the hotel comes out of one of the stalls, and he talks to Jerry, and he does not wash his hands, and he tells Jerry, "I'm going to make a special salad for you."
Well, you know, every time I hear about, you know, 500 people on a cruise liner, they all came down with dysentery or whatever. I mean, obviously, one of the helpers that makes the salads, whatever, it didn't wash his hands. I remember a few years ago, we were in Las Vegas with a bunch of people, and we all went to the buffet, and whoever had a particular dish, it was some kind of rice dish, whoever had that dish got sick. So we figured out what happened, that one of the helpers who made that stuff, that rice dish, didn't wash their hands.
Well, I'll tell you, I don't go to buffets anymore, because if you see, you know, it's the food looks beautiful, but it's open. You know, who knows who put their hand in there, tasted it, or what microbes or whatever got into it.
You don't know. You have no clue. I mean, it's just taking a pot shot at the potluck.
Potluck, okay. Getting to pot.
Well, not today. Uh-huh. Oh, you heard about bitcoins, right? Well, thanks to the efforts of two entrepreneurs that are well known, the Winklevoss twins of Facebook fame, the Bitcoin, the virtual currency, is still with us.
Are the Winklevoss twins, are they the ones that sued?
They sued and they got a nice payoff, but
not enough.
Not enough. It's never enough. Anyway, did you watch the Super Bowl?
I watched it, and I know what you did.
Oh, yeah, I went to the movies. I saw a great movie that was American Hustle. And then we went out to dinner with friends. The Winklevoss twins of Facebook.
Now, how many of you people out there did watch the Super Bowl?
The virtual currency.
I think it was like 111 million.
111 million. Wow, that's a lot of people. So I ask all of you mothers out there, do you want your boy to grow up to become a professional football player?
If he can make $25, $30 million a year.
Well, they don't make anywhere as near that amount. Now, aside from being able to get laid all the time, which professional football players do, so I'm told, the job itself is not all that it is hyped up to be. Whenever you see a summary of the top 50 jobs in the country, the category of professional football player, it's always near the bottom of the list, usually 50 or 49. Okay, so that takes you what the job is all about.
Well, listen, my son plays soccer, and he's a goalkeeper in high school. And I'll tell you, sometimes he gets hit, and he goes down and holds his head or his leg, and
Yeah, and they don't wear any protection when they play soccer. No helmets, no padding, nothing.
And not even a cup.
Not even a cup, thank you, to drink from.
Actually, the ones on the field wear shin guards.
Yeah, that's shin mandatory. Guards, right.
It's about the only protection they have.
Yeah, that's the most predominant part of the body that's going to get kicked or whatever.
But if which I never knew, take a look when those guys go up where it's called headers, and you have two guys trying to hit the same ball with two heads.
Oh, boy, that must hurt when they
slide. That hurt. Anyway.
Yeah, well, professional football players, they don't have a long life expectancy at the sport, and they all, they're always at the risk of having some kind of permanent injury. So who's at the top of the list? Well, whenever I look, the job that is always one of the top three is that of actuary.
An actuary? Do you know any actuaries?
I used to in my prior life.
Well, one day we'll go through it again. What the hell is an actuary?
Yeah, that's a whole program by itself. Let's not bore our listeners today.
Okay, what should we bore them with?
Well, here's one, and everybody knows about Punxsutawney Phil, who's better known as PP to all of his furry friends and neighbors. He is a famous groundhog in, yes, sir, Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. He briefly popped out of his hole in the ground and made the prediction that we will have six more weeks of winter, but he definitely declined to predict who will win the Super Bowl.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I guess he doesn't follow up on sports that much.
Well, I know this was, I read in the paper, it was 128th anniversary time. I'm wondering how many times he was right and how many times he was wrong.
Well, we could Google it.
Now, if anybody out in our mass audience knows, could you call us up at 800-336-2225?
Please, we'll be waiting with bated breath. Hey, it's coming. The legal cultivation of hemp is now closer than you think. Already 9 states, including California, have passed legislation regarding the farming of industrial hemp. I don't see why not. Growing hemp was a viable farm product as far back as the Revolutionary War. And we already import in excess of $500 million worth of hemp-related products from overseas.
Well, is hemp technically the marijuana? Is the plant?
It's in that family. It's in that family. Now, you can buy hemp seed at Costco right now, today. And that stuff can be used to make all kinds of fabrics, carpeting, cosmetics, and pharmaceuticals.
But the important thing, can it make marijuana?
Itself, it can't, but it's in that category. Like, for instance, there's no way you could get high on carpeting made from hemp because industrial hemp cannot exceed 0.3% of THC, which is the active ingredient in marijuana, which has on the average about 10% of THC.
Yeah, but I remember back in the old days in Greenwich Village when I was a teenager, they used to make synthetic a pot, and they would have the pills. You didn't even have to smoke. You could take a pill.
To prevent pregnancy, to take the pill? Which pill are you talking about?
It was the same effect as you would smoke marijuana. I don't know if they have it now.
I don't know about that, Malcolm. That's your area of expertise.
It was my era.
Your era.
Like that.
All right, listen, real briefly, we have a special guest today, and this is as part of our tribute to Black History Month. February is Black History Month. And our guest today is probably waiting in the wings, and we will have him on right after the break.
Well, actually, he's on the phone now. We can say hi.
He's on the phone now? Okay, then let me introduce our listening audience to Dr. Daniel Hallman. Dr. Hallman is the chief of, he'll tell us what his full title is, but he runs the history section for the Air Force stationed in Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama.
Organizational Histories Division.
Okay, Dr. Hallman, why don't you tell us briefly what your full title is?
Okay, I'm the chief of the Organizational Histories Branch of the Air Force Historical Research Agency at Maxwell Air Force Base.
So are you a civilian or are you in the service?
I'm a civilian.
Civilian.
But I've been working here for over 31 years.
Wow. Okay, so you know all about what the Tuskegee Airmen did or did not do.
Well, I know a lot about what they did and didn't do because their documents are here at the agency. We are similar to an archives, we're the repository of Air Force historical documents related to Air Force organizations. And the 332nd Fighter Group, which was the Tuskegee Airmen Group in World War II, the documents related to them are here, including histories and mission reports and so on.
Okay. Only lately have we seen recognition of what they did in some of the movies. But there are always errors, or technical errors, like flying the wrong airplane at the wrong time, or not having the right insignia, or being referred to, and I've seen this in the movie, the 332nd Fighter Squadron, and small technical things like that. And for years, I mean truly years, nobody knew about what the Tuskegee Airmen did or that they even existed.
That's true. The first couple of decades after World War II, the histories and mission reports and a lot of the documents related to the World War II organizations were classified. And many of the details about what those organizations did in World War II were not well known. For the Tuskegee Airmen, which was the 99th Fighter Squadron at first, and then the 332nd Fighter Group.
Can you hold that thought for a minute? I guess we're up to a break.
Don't go away. Stay with us.
We're on CRN Digital Talk on the internet on crntalk.com. We'll be back in a few minutes. Stay tuned to The View from over here.
Hi there, Stan Weisleder here. I'm back with Malcolm Berman in the studio and our special guest for today, Dr. Daniel Hallman.
And you're on CRN Digital Talk and crntalk.com. come.
Don't forget the come. So, Dr. Holman, you still with us?
Yes, I am.
All right. Listen, like we were talking before, a lot of people never even heard of the Tuskegee Airmen, didn't even know that they were black fighter pilots doing their job during World War II. Now, you know, people don't think about it. They say, you know, it's in the movies, or they see things now. Once they see it in the movies, they accept it as a fact, okay? Back then, we didn't have black fighter pilots during the war. In fact, I remember a very popular series during the 60s or 70s, Hogan's Heroes, about a bunch of Air Force people in a German prison camp. And I remember they had a token black guy in the prison with the rank of sergeant.
Yeah, and his name was, the actor was Ivan Dixon, excellent
and
actor.
That couldn't have been because there were no sergeants who would have been a bomber crew member shot down. The only ones they had as prisoners were officers, maybe two dozen or so. So that was an immediate inaccuracy, but it was a token representation that wasn't true.
Yes, the Tuskegee Airmen who fought in combat overseas during World War II were fighter pilots, the ones that actually flew over enemy territory. And there were some Tuskegee Airmen shot down, but they, like you said, were officers.
They were all officers.
Right.
They couldn't have been a sergeant. It's possible maybe one of them was a warrant officer, but definitely an officer. As far as I know, they were all of the rank of lieutenant or above.
The pilots, the Tuskegee Airmen pilots, were all officers. That's right.
Okay, fact, then there was an inaccuracy in that program, Hogan's Heroes.
Well, I've seen the Red Tails, and also the people who service a plane were African Americans, were black.
That's right, they were.
So what rank were they?
Sergeant,
they were
corporal?
They were enlisted. The personnel on the ground primarily were enlisted, and for every pilot, it's estimated there were some 10 on the ground that were helping support the pilot. But the only ones that were actually shot down over enemy territory were the pilots, and they would have been officers. I wanted to mention that Alexander Jefferson is one of the Tuskegee Airmen who was shot down and became a prisoner of war in Germany for 9 months. He's still living.
He's still living.
Right. There were several Tuskegee Airmen like him.
Now, I have a question for you. Were there any females that served with those units?
No. Not in the military units.
No nurses that went overseas with them.
I'm sorry?
There were no nurses or medical assistants that went overseas with them.
No, but there were black nurses that worked at Tuskegee Army Airfield.
Okay, but they were here in the States.
That's right.
Yeah. How did they get... did all the officers and the men, were they from Tuskegee? No,
they were from all over the country.
So why were they?
Why did they train them there? Because there was segregation on a big scale back then.
That's one reason they chose that place, because segregation was already established in that area of the country, and the military training was going to be on a segregated basis. But there were two other reasons Tuskegee was chosen. One of them was the climate. There were a lot more good flying days in the south than in the north. And another reason was because Tuskegee Institute at the time lobbied actively for the to be the place where the training would take place.
Mm-hmm. All right, that I didn't know. Okay, that's an interesting fact.
Now you've seen the movie, I assume, Red Tails?
Yes, there were two movies made about the Tuskegee Airmen. One of them was an HBO movie in the 1990s.
Yeah, did you notice the HBO movie had them flying P-51Ds about 2 years before they were actually made?
Well, they flew different models of P-51.
Yeah, they started with the P-51C, but in the HBO movie, they were flying P-51Ds about 2 years before they were actually produced.
Well, Dr. Holman, think about it. We have to come up to a break again, but I wanted to...
Another break,
but I wanted to find out what you thought the inaccuracies of the movie is and how you like to correct it.
Sure.
Okay.
I'll be glad to talk about that.
Okay. Well, you're listening to a CRN Digital Talk on crntalk.com, and we'll be back in a few minutes. Stay tuned.
Hi there, Stan Weisleder back in the studio with Malcolm Berman and our special guest for today, Dr. Daniel Hallman.
On CRN Digital Talk and crntalk.com.
So we are not only all over the U.S., we are all over the planet and the far reaches of the galaxy.
And just a quickie, you can reach us at any time at www.viewfromoverhere.com.
Or you can call us at 800-336-2225.
Okay, let's get back to the doctor.
Okay, Doc. I'm going to call you Doc for short, like I do all doctors.
That's all right.
Malcolm gave you a question before our station break. And, Malcolm, you want to take it from there?
Yeah. I mean, the question was, how accurate were both of the movies? Red Tail, I saw the HBO special. I didn't. But they were they accurate depictions of that time and what happened?
Well, there were inaccuracies in both of them. And let me say, first of all, before I say anything too critical about the Red Tails movie by George Lucas, I'm one of the technical advisors listed at the end of the movie, so I shouldn't be too critical.
Better
of it.
Watch it.
But there were some inaccuracies in both movies, and if I might, in the HBO movie, the greatest inaccuracy was the statement that the Tuskegee Airmen never lost a bomber. And that is not an accurate statement. There were missions in which Tuskegee Airmen escorted bombers were shot down by enemy aircraft. It was rare, but it happened. In the other movie, the Red Tails movie, there were some inaccuracies, too. And I first of all have to say that at least the movies like that focus attention on the Tuskegee Airmen and what they did in World War II and help bring that to the attention of the public. That's the greatest compliment for
yeah,
movies
at the
like
beginning,
that.
It did say based on.
Right. And the biggest problem to me with not using real names is that when I see a movie with a historical theme, I'm often inspired to go look up information about the people the movie is about, even if the movie is not exactly accurate. But in the case of Red Tails, the real names were not used.
Was there a reason for that?
I think so. I think they didn't want to...
get sued?
Well, I don't know if I would put it that way, but they didn't want to... offend the families by using the real names of the people who were.
Yeah, now what about that? They showed that one of the black pilots escaped from prison camp?
Yes, I saw that scene in the movie.
Yeah, did that happen? Because I'd never found anything like that in all of my research.
Well, there were definitely Tuskegee Airmen that were shot down over enemy territory, were made prisoners of war.
Yeah, but none escaped, right?
But not escaped, no. I'm not aware of any of them that escaped, except if they went down over enemy territory and didn't go to a prisoner of war camp. There were some, for example, that were shot down or had mechanical difficulty and were forced down over enemy territory who did not go to a prisoner of war camp, who did eventually make their way back.
Yeah, my research shows that there were two of such pilots. One of them ended up with the Greeks and another one with the Yugoslavs. In fact, after the war, one of the pilots, I forget his name, one of the pilots was given an award by the government of Yugoslavia for the time that he spent with them helping or whatever.
Well, there was another Tuskegee Airman that was shot down over northern Italy and spent several months with the partisans in northern Italy, and he eventually made his way back to his unit. I might mention, I know we have limited time here, but if anybody would like to know information about the details of the Tuskegee Airmen mission. There's a chronology in a book that I co-authored called The Tuskegee Airmen and Illustrated History.
Oh, that book I have to get a hold of.
And where can they access it?
And that book has my chronology in it that has details about every Tuskegee Airmen bomber escort mission, strafing mission for the 15th Air Force, some of the missions for the 12th Air Force before that. And
okay,
so,
how do we get that book and where?
The book is published by New South Books.
New South
Montgomery,
Books.
Okay. Alabama. And it's called The Tuskegee Airmen, An Illustrated History, 1939 to 1949. And I need to mention my co-authors, too. Joseph Caver and Jerome Ennals also worked here at the Air Force Historical Research Agency when the book was published. Joseph Caver has since retired, but Jerome Ennals is still working here at the agency with me.
Well, Doctor, do you have a website that people could look you up and see what you've done? And
Well, we have an Air Force Historical Research Agency website, and you could just, I don't know if I should use the word Google. I don't want to promote any one particular
You can use the word Google. It's become part of the vocabulary.
Yeah, if you Google the Air Force Historical Research Agency, then you'll get our homepage. And you could find reference on that homepage to the organizational histories of all the Air Force units.
Well, did you know now what's the ratio between pilots and how many are African American, how many are Native American, or, you know, white? Is there a statistic on that?
You mean today or back then?
Today.
I did a comparison today or recently with the proportion today and the proportion in World War II. I don't remember the exact figures. I'd have to look up that information that I looked up. But it's greater today, the percentage of blacks in the Air Force today and pilots today is greater than it was in World War II.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But it's still not nearly as great as the population in general.
Right, yeah. I'm just wondering what the the prejudice against
but you know something,
you know,
aside from the prejudice, aside from the prejudice, general common knowledge, when I talk to people, a lot of black people were not aware of the Tuskegee Airmen. As many or maybe more than the white people.
Well, Dr. Holman, I think we've run out of time. I thank you very much for being on the show. And
appreciate the opportunity, and I do want to say that the book I mentioned is not an Air Force book, so it's really separate from the web page that I mentioned.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what. Send us the information. We will put it on our website so people can get it.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And I have one last question for you.
And we have 15
the next
seconds.
Few seconds. Doctor, have you read the novel that I wrote, A Killer of Lions?
No, I haven't. I'd like to read that.
I'll put one in the mail to you.
Okay.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Thank you, Doctor. We'll be right back with the View from Over Here.
Hi, Stan Weisleder. I'm back again with Malcolm. And I believe we have J&J on the phone.
Jerry and Jeff are with us. And
yes,
I have no idea what they're going to talk about.
Go ahead, Jerry.
Are you up, Jerry?
Yes. Yes, I am.
Don't wake him, Malcolm. Let him doze.
Finishing my breakfast.
Are we talking about your breakfast, or do you have any commentary on entertainment in general, or Israel, or the rabbinical state of whatever?
Jeff, aside from the Hoffman terrible, terrible news, his overdosing.
Yeah.
Jeff and I both were very saddened, because what a great, great artisan he was.
Well, he also seemed to be a very great person, a good person, aside from his his acting abilities.
Yeah, I'm sure he was. Yeah, we never met him unless Jeff did, and
no,
I wasn't aware of it. No,
okay. No.
No, I've never met him, but the stories that you're getting on the cable TV, you know, it's all full of it for the last 2 days. But supposedly he was, he had no pretense of being a movie star. He was, you know, he was out in the community. He took his kids to school. He went to the local bars.
He was a good
And I hear that at Sundance, someone didn't recognize him, and he had, that hat on. And they said, "Who are you? What are you doing?" He said, "I'm a heroin addict." And then when he took off his hat, and they said, "Oh, you're Philip Seymour Hoffman."
He was very open about his addictions.
Yeah, he was. He was. Very sad to have a disease like that. Anyway, this week we're going to be talking about Tim's Vermeer.
Tim's Vermeer.
And we, Jerry and I certainly don't agree on this one.
What else is new?
Tim's Vermeer is a documentary about Johannes Vermeer.
Who was?
He was an artist, a very great artist.
He was one of the great Dutch artists, and was known for his lighting within his paintings. He was written up in the Times last week.
The documentary.
Oh,
the
okay.
documentary.
Yeah. Well, until I saw this. I thought that Vermeer was a gloss you put on furniture. Because
that's
not
veneer.
Well,
his N's and his M's mixed up constantly.
I'm not as
a one-letter difference, veneer or Vermeer.
Yeah. Right. Well, now you tell me. But Jeff is much more cultural than I, so I had no idea. She's into everything, anything cultural.
Well, I don't think this has the documentary has nothing about being into culture. I think what it is it's such an interesting documentary on science versus, artistic endeavor. And Vermeer's, his paintings are so perfectly painted with the way the light would shine through a room. And in the documentary, they talk to a he's an eye surgeon, and the eye surgeon says, the iris cannot pick up the intricacies of the change of color on a wall to the extent that Vermeer paints them. And some of the other artists, Dutch artists also.
Now remember, he was an artist in the 17th century, and he was a very revered artist. The picture that they utilize of his, the painting, is called The Music Lesson. And, Malcolm, I'm sure you've seen this hundreds of times, that same picture as I have, but glanced at it and enjoyed it without thinking anything more profound than that.
Yeah, right.
So this was produced by Penn and Teller. And Teller directed it. And Penn is the one who asks him some questions.
I have to ask you a question. Penn and Teller, are they supposed to be magicians or comedians? Which are they?
Well, they're both. They're comedic magicians. And that's what I expected here when I said, they're talking about the light and how the infusion of the light. So I figured they're going to show some magic dealing with the painting, but it has nothing to do with magic.
So you and Jeff disagree. Are you pro or are you con?
Well, I thought it was, it plodded along. It wasn't that exciting for me. It was too methodical. It was too slow. And if I see a work of art, I don't go beyond it. I don't understand poetry, architecture, art. I can look at all three and appreciate it for what it is, but I don't delve
and
into the
profundity.
And he's
bloody well proud of it.
Okay, either you like it or you don't like it. You don't try to analyze it.
Exactly. And, I'm not that analytical. If I wake up in the morning, I see birds, I see trees, I said, God bless, is that beautiful? I don't know. I don't know deeper than that.
I think this was much more exciting than what Jerry is making it out to be, because there was a Professor Stedman who'd written a book who suggested that Vermeer had used a camera obscura back in that time. And this went a step beyond that. And there are many, many people who are upset.
And here, Jerry and Jeff, if you want to hold on for a minute.
Yes,
don't go away. We have to do one of those breaks.
And we'll find out more from The View from Over Here on CRN. Talk.com.
You forgot what it is?
I forgot. We'll be back in a few minutes. Bye-bye.
Hi there. Stan Weisleder. I'm back with Malcolm Berman.
We're back.
And we have our guests today, our movie experts, Jerry and Jeff.
Hey, guys, can we call you the odd couple?
We're the answer to the Bickersons. We're today's Bickersons.
Hey, listen, real briefly, I know you covered this movie weeks ago, but this past weekend, instead of watching the Super Bowl, we went to see one of the movies that you reviewed, and that is American Hustle, and we thought it was great.
Wasn't it fabulous?
And I loved the way Christian Bale came on with the New York accent. He was unbelievable.
He is amazing as an actor. He really is.
Yet we heard from some people that they didn't like it. They walked out in the middle, and one person fell asleep. I can't imagine how.
Me either, Stan. And someone, I forget who it was saying, I didn't see it as a comedy. I said, it was most definitely a comedy.
I did not necessarily see it as a comedy.
Well, it was very comical. Yeah, I got to tell you, that girl, that...
Amy Adams?
Carol Lawrence.
Jennifer Lawrence.
I knew it was a Lawrence somewhere in there. She was unbelievable.
She's brilliant. She's one of the great actresses, young actresses.
And she's so young.
This is the first time I've seen her in a movie. I didn't see those Hunger Games or anything like that.
I didn't even see the Silver Lining, whatever.
But she was, I thought, incredible.
Jeff asked you if you saw Silver Linings Playbook.
I'm looking for it on the HBO or
one
of those channels.
Wait, let me get back to Tim's Vermeer.
Okay. Vermeer.
Vermeer,
yeah.
It's the story of this guy, which is why it's interesting, Tim Jennison. He was a very successful inventor, made millions of dollars. And he always felt that Vermeer cheated. He used opticals to paint. He spent 5 years, first of all, reconstructing the room where he had painted in a San Antonio barn. He refurbished his barn to look like the room, and using optics. He painted. He never painted before in his life, and he painted a very good copy of the picture.
Yeah, but did he really paint it, or did he do it digitally?
No, he didn't do it digitally. He tried the camera obscura initially, which is how they thought Vermeer did six of his paintings.
Around back then?
Yes, of course it was. It's like a black room that you look at, and you have the sunshine on the article you want to paint. But what he did went a step further. He made a mirror that would have been of that time, and it was exactly what Vermeer had done.
Jerry, talk fast. We have only 45 seconds left. Jerry and Jeff, thanks for being on. We'll have to continue this on our next show because we've run out of time. Thanks again.
There'll be another show.
Oh,
okay.
If God be willing.
All right.
You're listening to The View from Over Here on CRN Digital Talk, crntalk.com. Visit us on www.viewfromoverhere.com, and we'll see you. No, we have 30 seconds left.
30 seconds? Oh, he made a mistake.
Again, it's www.viewfromoverhere.com without the.
And they can call us at, go ahead,
800-336-2225. And next week we'll have a woman toting a gun, Paxton Quigley. We'll see you then. Have a good week. Bye-bye.
The View from Over Here is a co-production of Infinity X and TBG International. For further information, contact Malcolm Berman at 818-687-2784. That's 818-687-2784.